And it hits me, oh my gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
He saw a classic flying saucer, really, standing in the clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes and he said, "We're not alone."
Welcome to Podcast UFO for our live show. We're live every Wednesday on the Dark Matter Radio Network. Please remember to visit the website podcastufo.com for past episodes, blogs, and forums. During the show, feel free to participate live in our chat room. And don't forget to like us on our very active Facebook page.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Martin Willis, your host. We're coming at you live like every Wednesday at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Dark Matter Radio Network. Just a quick note, Stanton T. Friedman is home from the hospital and he's doing quite well, so we expect a good recovery from him. And if you're listening live, you may want to jump in our chat room, which is right on podcastufo.com. You know, we have an extraordinary show for you this evening, and you've never heard me say that before, have you? Our guest for the evening, a little bit later on, is Nick Redfern. He's going to be talking about his recent book, Close Encounters of the Fatal Kind. And you've probably heard about the Chilean government's recent report on the, they're stating their analysis on two pictures showing UFOs. It's a great breaking story, and I'm excited to say for the first part of the show, we have investigative journalist, who I'm sure you all know out there, Leslie Kane. And joining us from the Chilean government's agency, CEFA-A, which stands for Committee for the Studies of Anomalous Aerial Phenomena in Spanish, of course, is Jose Lai. And welcome to the show, both Leslie and Jose.
Thanks, Martin. Great to be here.
Thank you, Martin.
Yeah.
Nice to hear you again.
Yes. I got to meet you both last year and really enjoyed the company of you both. And Leslie, I want to congratulate you first for breaking this great story. And please, if you would, give us a summary of it, what has happened since this came hot off the press, so to speak.
Okay, well, just in a nutshell, for people who haven't read it, and by the way, they can go to HuffingtonPost.com and just put my name in there, or go to my Facebook page, and there's a link to the story. But basically, what it is that some very sophisticated technical employees at a mine in northern Chile spent about over an hour viewing a UFO in the sky. There were four of them and witnessed it, and it did all kinds of maneuvers and hovered and went up and down and back and forth. And there were two pictures that they took. Now, these people didn't want have anything to do with this publicly, and so they just kept the pictures to themselves. A few months later, one of them showed the images to an engineer at the mine who was very impressed with them, asked for copies, and sent two photos to the CEFA-A because this engineer knew that this was the government agency that was responsible for dealing with UFO issues in the country. This is an official agency. And they decided, after having eliminated all possible explanations, conventional explanations for this, and being a government agency, they have the capability of getting data on any type of data that they need in order to determine whether something has an explanation. So they did a very thorough analysis on that level and discovered that there really was no explanation for this, and then they decided to have the pictures analyzed. And just last week, the CEFA-A released the analysis by a technician of theirs, a technical expert connected with the CEFA-A, who did an analysis and put it, they made this public. And so I was, of course, when it became public, I was very interested in getting the word out to the mainstream, and that's when I did the story. But that's essentially what the story is, and people need to go on to the site to actually see the pictures.
And what has happened since this thing has come out?
Well, there's been kind of a firestorm. I mean, I'm quite surprised, actually, about the reaction. The story on the Huffington Post has received more than 1 million reader views so far.
Amazing.
I mean, way over a million, 100,000 or something like that. And there's lots of other media that's picked it up. It's been on Fox News. It's been on a major newspaper in the UK, a major venue in Australia. just about every blog out there that, you know, deals with UFOs has picked it up. So it's right. just getting a lot of attention, and I'm kind of surprised, but I think why it's important is that we have an actual government of a country that has released these photographs and has made the statement that they are a UFO, meaning something unexplained. But for a government of a country to come out and say that is a significant thing, and it doesn't happen very often.
And we'll talk about a little the question up on the chat room. We'll talk a little bit later about the more or less summary of the findings. But one of the things that occurred to me as I was reading this is often you hear about UFOs near, like, large mineral deposits. And I'm not going to say any type of speculation why that is. But do you know if this is a one-time sighting, Jose?
No, it is not just a one-time sighting. We have enough evidence to believe that the phenomenon we call UAP does exist, coming from our pilots, military and civilians, radar data. We have so many cases that actually leave no shadow of a doubt that something is going on, that the phenomenon does exist. So, we were obviously very curious about this case, this particular case, because we usually concentrate on our aeronautical sightings, not much civilian sightings, but this particular case was really interesting, and we thought it was worth a study. So there it is, you see, but we never expected it to become news, actually.
Wow. No. Sorry for the confusion. I meant, is this a one-time sighting at this particular mine that you're aware of?
Well, there have been several other sightings in different mines. As you know, perhaps, Chile is, I think, is number one or number two in the world producer of copper and silver.
Oh.
And well, let me think. We have about three or four cases of different mines up there in the mountains that they have seen UFOs. We call them UAP, but well, yeah. So it is nothing new, actually.
Yes, yes. And
Martin, may I say one more thing?
Sure, go right ahead.
Because yeah. I neglected to say a really important aspect about this case is that these were daylight sightings. And I guess for people who haven't looked at the pictures were taken at around noon and bright, clear skies. And the skies in northern Chile are among the clearest, cleanest skies in the world. Just crystal clear. But the fact that they were daylight sightings is really important, as the pictures are very good. And one of them shows an actually sort of, because it's noon, the sun is pretty much directly above the object. And one of them has this very bottom, kind of a half sphere coming out of the bottom of the object, which is illuminated brilliantly. And it seems to be that this illumination comes from within the object, rather, because the sun is above it. It's not just reflecting the sun. You can see rays of light coming out from along the sides of the object. So it's really quite a striking picture. But I just wanted to mention about the daylight part, because that's really important.
Yeah, and this thing was flying around for hovering for about an hour, which is amazing. And it's great
more
to
than
see,
an hour.
More than an hour. It's great to see really clear pictures. Instead of, you know, a lot of times, you know, people that are skeptic out there, you know, say, why are the pictures always blurry? Well, these aren't. These are great pictures. And let's see, up on the message board. Anyone can join the message board if you're listening live. It's really easy to join. It's just two clicks, and it's on podcastufo.com. And up on the message board, someone is asking, is she, but it can address either one of you. I'm going to give a summary of the findings. Jose, would you like to address that?
Oh, yes. Do I have to give you my my mail or something like that?
No.
I didn't understand very well.
No, okay, let me put it a different way. Can you give what type of research went into this, and what did you discover as you were researching?
Oh, yes. Of course, first of all, there was the curiosity, and we decided. First of all, I think I have to explain how our committee works.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we have what we might call a steady committee of people that are always at the CEFHA office. We have our one director, which is a retired Air Force general, General Ricardo Bermudez. Then we have a person in charge of national affairs. I'm in charge of international affairs. We are a secretary. But behind us, we have a panel of scientists. I think we have now 16 of them, doctorates in different disciplines from different universities, including a national prize in science. We have also two astronomers that are very well known all over the world. One of them has an asteroid named after his own name, of course, and another one that has discovered many new galaxies. So we have a whole scientific panel behind us. On top of that, we have each of the branches of the armed forces, Air Force, Navy, Army, and police. They also have liaison officers that report anything that happens that it is unusual to us directly, to our office. So we can cover the whole country of anything that might be unusual. And on to add to that, the people in Chile, they all know about our office, and they report to us directly without having to go to the newspapers or something or things like that. So we receive these kind of reports, and those that are really extraordinary, like in this case, because Collahuasi, which is the case we are talking about, it is a purely civilian case that has nothing to do with airspace or aeronautics. But it was so interesting that we decided to submit it to an analysis. And one of our analysts, he concluded that it was actually a solid object, a UFO. And that's how matters stand now.
Mm-hmm. Listen, you know, we have some great questions coming up. And I have some of my own as well. A question up here. Does Bruce Maccabee states in the article, though, the inability to question witnesses does reduce the credibility. And the question is, by chance, does our guest know, that means you, Jose, why they are unable to question the witnesses or if they'll be able to interview them at a later time?
Well, you have to be a Chilean professional in order to understand that.
Uh-huh.
And we do understand the reluctance to come forward and talk about it. They really don't want any publicity. They don't want their names to become known. They were not willing to show the evidence, and it was by accident that we received it. That is the problem. we tried to contact them, and they were very politely refused, and they have all the right to do so, you know, not to talk about it, the thing that just happened, and that was it. They want to forget all about it. They are working in a mine, and they want to live their life, their lives quietly. They don't want the press, the television to go 4,300 meters above sea level to bother them. That is the problem.
Right. We're so crunched for time, and we're going to stretch it a little bit further. What about the highest level authorities in the Chile government? How are they responding to this, Jose?
Well, in our case, CEFA-A, which is the Committee of Studies of Anomalous Aerial Phenomenon, our highest authority is the Minister of Defense, but we depend directly from the Air Force. Therefore, our highest authority is the Commander-in-Chief of our Air Force. And I would like to break the news, which made us very happy and very sad at the same time, because the Air Force had named a very nice person as a representative of our Air Force to CEFA-A as a liaison officer, and he now is retired, to give us every information, radar, sighting of military pilots that had of anything which is anomalous to CEFA-A. And now there is a new high-ranking officer that's been named, especially by the Commander-in-Chief of the Air Force, to represent the Air Force to our committee, just as we have from the Navy, the Army, and the police, civilian police, like the FBI, your equivalent, and our uniform police. Mm-hmm. So we covered the whole country. Anything that moves and we can detect it, it immediately goes into CEFA-A. On top of that, we have that 85% of our population believes that there must be life outside our world, and they also believe in the phenomenon that actually it exists. Because we have so many.
May I jump
many.
In for a second?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, Jose. I think what we're interested. You know, would you be willing to share what the commander in chief's response has been? You mentioned to me that the commander in chief of the Air Force actually made a comment about this to you guys.
Oh,
can
yes.
you share that?
Oh yes. Oh yes. We had to appear in several television channels due to this case, this particular case, and by coincidence, the commander-in-chief saw one of the television programs, and he instructed, suggested the DGAC director, which is another general, Air Force general, in active duty, to encourage the CEFA-A to continue the good work we are doing. And actually, we're just doing a normal work.
Mm-hmm. Boy, I'll tell you what, I hope, you know, the only hope that I can really have on this is that someone in the U.S. is going to pay attention to this and see how simple it can be if we could set up something like that in this country, you know, because I really do believe that, you know, when you're saying 85% of the people understand that there's most likely life on other planets, I think that is, that's kind of, I think that's going global.
Of course.
With, you know, Kepler and all the findings they have out there. We have just a few minutes to wrap this up before We have to bring in our other guests. Now, is there anything that you can use, other breaking news you can give us since the story has come out? Has anything changed or come up that is notable?
Yes, I would like to say that we have sent the same material, visual material, to Dr. Bruce Maccabee in the United States to review it. He accepted to take a look at it. We're also sending it to Europe, to François Louange, which is a member of 3AF Sigma Group in France. And it's a group where we have very close relations. And we're waiting the results, and we're being very objective about it. And we're just trusting that the analysis is going to be, what our own specialist concluded. And also, we have called a general meeting with our scientists and the members of our different air forces, the armed forces, and all that, in order to reach a consensus about this case. But I think, like in every case, it's happening right now, is that we need and we are looking for what you in America call the smoking gun. That is the only thing we need in Chile. That's all.
Mm-hmm. Just, we have one last question that's been up on the message board, and that is, was there ever any radar of this that you're aware of?
No.
Okay.
But we do have what you may call UFO in radar in several cases. It's just a question of going into our webpage.
Oh.
We have radar cases. Of course we have. Otherwise, we will not be working.
Right. Can you give out your website address, please?
Yes. www.cefaa.cl.
Okay. And that's CEFAA.
Yes.
And
yes. CL.
CL.
CL for Chile. Yes.
Very good. You know what? I'm going to squeeze this last question in. Are there specific places in Chile where these UFOs are landing or ever seen landing? Has anyone ever noted one landing?
Yes, yes. We have a case reported by an air traffic controller in one of our secondary airports. It's called Tobalaba case, and it is in our webpage there. I think I'm going to translate it into English, and because it is really very interesting. It landed, and then it took off again. And the air traffic controller really described it. However, unfortunately, it is rather old, and CFAA did not exist at that time. We also have cases in Antarctica, in the Antarctic continent, in our bases there. We also have in our Africa cases, for example. If you go into our webpage, when you open the CFAA page, you can hear a pilot saying, "I have a light right in front of me. Do you have a traffic?" And the air traffic controller said, "No. We don't have any traffic reported, but I can see the light going right in front of you."
Wow, that is so great. Leslie, I want to congratulate you once again for such a wonderfully written article and also the visibility this is getting. It's wonderful. I feel honored to have you both on. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us, Martin.
Myself.
All right.
Thank you.
We hope to have you back for sure.
Martin, and I would like to inform you also that General Bermudez sent you many greetings also, and he is our director, and he wanted me to make a special point of the fact that Leslie Kane, she's our official spokesperson in the United States.
Wonderful. Yes. Leslie, we all really appreciate that. Thank you both so much. And it's time we're going to have to drop out with you and bring our guest in. So
thanks, Martin. Bye.
Bye-bye now.
Happy to hear you.
All right. Great to talk to you. Talk to you soon.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye. All right. Now we're going to bring in our guest, Nick Redfern. And we have to do this the old-fashioned way. And the phone is dialing. So that was pretty exciting to have them on. And now our guest, Nick Redfern, is coming up.
Hello.
Hello, Nick. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks, Martin.
Yeah, thanks so much for joining us again. We had you back, a number of months ago. And during our conversation, you mentioned this book you were writing, which is called Close Encounters of the Fatal Kind. So thanks so much for joining us, and it's quite a book. I've been in it for the last. I got to admit, I'm not the fastest reader out there. I did get through it. I just have a lot going on, is what it is. It's not really a real upbeat or enlightening topic, but it's one that needed to be addressed, and I'm glad you wrote the book. Can you tell the listening audience how you came about the topic? What made you decide to write this book?
Well, yeah, I mean, when you're sort of writing a book on any subject, and you know, people are going to go out and buy it, you want to be able to give them something new. You don't want to just go over old ground. And so that's sort of one of the main things I always think about when I'm writing a book, what hasn't been done before in book format. And it kind of surprised me, I guess, that nobody had really done a full-length book on all the sort of various unexplained deaths and mysterious and suspicious deaths in ufology from the 40s to the present day. You know, there were sort of people had written maybe a chapter or an article here, there online or whatever, but there'd never been a full length study of the whole thing. So that was basically the reason for doing it, that to bring something new and to demonstrate to people that it's not just, you know, a bunch of paranoid rubbish or whatever, that there actually are some genuine or a lot of genuinely weird deaths within ufology, and many of them people just don't know about, haven't heard about, and so, you know, to help inform people, just put it out there. So.
Right. Now, I believe I spoke to you about this as well. I had talked to Peter Robbins about this subject quite a while ago, and it was something he was contemplating as well. So your timing was good.
Well, I do know that Peter did a very good paper on James Forrestal's death, the first Secretary of Defense. I remember Peter gave a lecture on it, I think probably about 10 years ago at Ryan Wood's UFO Crash Retrieval Conference in Vegas, probably about 2003, 2004, something like that. So, that alone, you know, somebody, maybe Peter, I mean, that could be the subject of an entire book, the Forrestal death, and so many twists and turns in that case.
Yes, I did. I got more than halfway through the book, so I did read through that, and that is an unusual case where he's left alone for a few minutes and tossed, but he had a fear of heights, and you know, I mean, and it's right in the CIA and how to assassinate, the kind of the same thing that happened to him, more or less. Do you want to go into that a little bit?
Well, yeah, sure. Well, James Forrestal was the first U.S. Secretary of Defense, and he was appointed to that position in 1947 by President Harry Truman, who was obviously the president at the time. Now, there have been a lot of stories and accounts within the UFO field that after Forrestal was appointed Secretary of Defense, that he received this sort of classified briefing on the UFO subject, and essentially what was known about the subject at that time. And bear in mind that the Kenneth Arnold sighting and Roswell were June and July 47, and Forrestal got the job in September. So there was only sort of 7 or 8 weeks worth of material to brief him on. So there probably wasn't that much, even though it was still very significant. Now, Forrestal was a very clever, sort of insightful guy who was good at sort of sizing up situations. You know, he was previously the Secretary of the Navy and someone who, during the Second World War, was responsible for a lot of good work, you know, helping the war effort. The only downside with Forrestal was he was a very emotional person, which isn't necessarily the best thing, I guess, when you're Secretary of Defense. He had a lot of sort of self-doubts, and his relationship with his wife suffered. They were sort of, just not well suited together after a while, but they stayed together. So a lot of things going on in the background. Now, there's a story that when Forrestal was briefed on the UFO subject, he had a lot of trouble dealing with it, that it caused him like a lot of stress and anxiety. The implication being that the briefing was filled with a lot of disturbing material that most of us don't know about, and you know that could well have been the case. But rather than sort of dealing with it, you know, we all, at the height of the Cold War, everybody dealt with the fact that the Russians could kill us any day, you know, with a nuclear war. He didn't kind of just put it to the back of his mind and get on with his job. The story is that it just obsessed him to the point where he plunged into like a complete nervous collapse, essentially. And what happened was that in March 1949, he was admitted to the Bethesda Naval Hospital in Maryland with essentially acute stress and a nervous psychological collapse. And he was in there until his death in May 1949, May the 22nd. And by all accounts, in the time that he was in there, which was on the 16th floor, he made a great deal of progress to the extent that by late April, he was sort of essentially back to normal. He had a military guard in there who Forrestal had actually said, look, when I come out of here, I want you as my personal chauffeur. And he got plans for a new job. And he didn't sound like a man who was at the edge of suicide or was just sort of curled up in the corner of the room crying or whatever. He'd actually sort of come through this dark period. And, you know, a lot of people in their lives have experiences like that, and they come out the other end, and that's what he did. And he was eating well, you know, he was showering and shaving. He wasn't just sort of not looking after himself. Now, one of the other stories that's very sort of enduring within the UFO field is that there were people on the inside who felt that Forrestal was a potential security risk if he decided to blow the whistle on what he knew about the UFO subject, i.e. to the media and to the general public. And so one of the theories is that he was essentially taken to Bethesda, not just for his own good, but so he couldn't release this story about what he knew about UFOs. And the story was that that's exactly what he wanted to do. He wanted to tell the world. Now, he never had a chance to do that because he died in the early hours of May the 22nd, 1949. Now, in the day before, the 21st, his brother phoned the hospital and said, look, I'm coming tomorrow and I'm going to take him home. And his brother just really didn't care whether or not the doctors there liked it or not. And his brother Henry said, you know, I'm bringing him home and you can like it or not like it, but that's what's going to happen. And if somebody was worried about Forrestal spilling the beans, and if somebody wanted to get rid of him, and his brother was going to come in on the 22nd, and he'd found the hospital on the 21st, well, that really only gave the night of the 21st or the early hours of the 22nd to get rid of him, which is exactly what happened. He died in the early hours of May the 22nd, and interestingly enough, it occurred when the guy who was guarding him, who actually wasn't the regular guard who he'd offered the chauffeuring job to, it was another one, said he had to leave the room, or was called out But the upshot was that Forrestal was left alone. And then when the guard got back, he wasn't there, and there was an open window, and the guards looked out, and there he was lying on an overhanging roof 13 floors down. It was actually the roof of the third floor, which stuck out. And, of course, if you fall 13 floors, you know, none of us are Superman. You know, you're just not going to survive. Now, there were a lot of weird aspects surrounding the death itself. The official line is that he took the cord from his dressing gown, put one end around his neck, tied the other end around the radiator, and then climbed out of the window and lowered himself down. But if you think about that, you know, you say double knot one end around a radiator, double knot the other end around your neck, and then there's still going to be enough cord for you to climb right out of the window with your entire body and lower yourself down from the other side. You know, it wasn't like he was, you know, in a 60-inch waist or anything like that. So yeah. That kind of sounds strange, you know, that he could do all that with just a regular waist cord. And the story is that he essentially tried to hang himself out the window, but the weight of his body and just being tied by a cord split the cord, and he just fell to his death. But there are actually signs outside the window of scratch marks where it looked like he'd been fighting to get back in, as if possibly, you know, somebody had forced him out of the window.
That's
and
so
to
sad.
His dying day, his brother Henry believed that Forrestal had been outright murdered. And as you pointed out, there actually is this official CIA document from the early 50s, which is officially being released through the Freedom of Information Act. And it's called A Study of Assassination. And it's essentially a guideline document for CIA personnel on how to make a murder look like a suicide or an accident. And the top of the list in making it work well is to throw somebody out of a high window onto a concrete floor. And so that's actually, you know, a recommendation in the document.
Right.
And it's exactly how Forrestal died.
Right, right. Now, a lot of this... There is this like mostly like fleeting evidence, sort of like the UFOs themselves? I mean, is there any case out there that you looked into that you could say, wow, you know, that is really, really solid? Can you go over that? Anything that you think?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's a good point. I mean, Forrestal's death is suspicious under any circumstances without, you know, bringing UFOs into the mix. But as I said, there are strands. But you're right, they're strands, and we need to put those strands together to a greater degree than we have already, if we can at least, because, you know, it's that long ago, and when people got onto the UFO angle, it was years later. But certainly there are other ones that, for me at least, point right in the direction of the UFO phenomenon. One of them I talk about in the book was the 1959 death of Morris K. Jessup, a UFO researcher who got involved in all sorts of stuff like ancient astronauts, UFOs in the 40s and 50s, the Philadelphia experiment, and then wound up dead. And Jessup was a guy who came from Michigan, and he developed an interest in the UFO subjects in the early 50s. And bearing in mind how long ago this was, he was sort of a really like a pioneer in the whole field of ancient astronauts. You know, we're talking 20 years almost before Eric von Daniken's Chariots of the Gods book came out, and sort of four decades before Zachariah Sitchin was on the scene. And Jessup traveled extensively to South America and Mexico and came to believe that the ancient structures there, like the massive South American pyramids, not too dissimilar to the Egyptian ones, were built by... He concluded they could only have been built by something like anti-gravity or levitation. And he came to the same conclusion for places like the pyramids in Egypt and Stonehenge. And now, whether or not that's true, that was the theory he was sort of promoting in the early 50s, that sort of levitation-type technology to lift these massive stones. And he was also heavily researching UFOs, as I said, in the late 40s and 50s. He wrote a number of books in the 50s, the most famous one being The Case for the UFO. Now, this was basically his most well-known and sort of fleshed-out book, and it's the one he's probably known for most of all. But the book itself has a weird history because not too long after it was published, a copy was mailed anonymously to a division of the U.S. Navy in Washington, D.C. It was specifically sent to a division that was like a special weapons division that, you know, was in the, involved in developing new futuristic weapons systems and so on. And the copy that was mailed anonymously to the Navy contained all these weird scribblings and notes where somebody had, you know, bought the book, and on each page they'd added all their own little words in pen. And all these notes related to two things. One, the issue of ancient technology being used to move these massive stones, like anti-gravity. And the other thing was a supposed 1943 experiment to try and make a U.S. Navy warship invisible. And this has become known as the Philadelphia experiment, this sort of controversial but famous story that in 43, a ship, the USS Eldridge, was made invisible, as in literally invisible, but had sort of terrible side effects on the crew, and the project was shut down. Now, whether or not that's true as well is kind of beside the point, but the intriguing thing is that when this copy of the book was mailed to this special weapons division in the Navy, they actually phoned Jessup up, found his number, phoned him up, and invited him out to D.C. for essentially like a day-long series of questions on his book and his theories and on the Philadelphia experiment. Jessup was a little bit concerned. You know, on the one hand, he was excited that somebody in the Navy, the government, was interested in his book. On the other hand, he was a bit worried, was this going to be like a good cop, bad cop scenario? Well, when he got out there, it actually turned out to be a good cop scenario. It was just a very relaxed interview. But that may have been deliberate. The idea was that that they asked him these questions all about his book and this research into anti-gravity, but they were clearly pushing to find out who this person might have been who was talking about the Philadelphia experiment. And with hindsight, it kind of sounds like there were concerns that somebody may have compromised a classified project, and they went to Jessup to figure out if he knew who it was. Well, Jessup immediately realized that the writing, the handwriting in this book, originated with a guy named Carlos Allende, who had been in communication with Jessup, actually, for a couple of years. He instantly recognized the writing and said, well, yes, this guy Allende. So that satisfied the Navy on that score. And Jessup went, they flew him back home. That's another thing, they covered all his expenses, his hotel, his food, flight, everything. So, you know, it was taken very seriously, the stuff he'd put in his book. Now, after he got back home, a lot of weird stuff began to happen. He'd sort of wake up in the middle of the night because the phone was ringing, you know, just jolting awake from a dead sleep. He'd race to get the phone because he thought it was bad news. I mean, if you get a call at like 4 a.m, that's everybody's first thought. You know, no matter where you are in the world, it's like, oh, God, you know, who's that calling? And it seems like this was done to essentially destabilize his sleep, which is exactly what happened. These calls would go on night after night, and, you know, his nerves became fried. Then he started getting weird hang-up calls and other times where he picked the phone up, and there were these strange electronic screeches and noises and sounds like what sounded like a fast, very rapid language, but a language he couldn't understand. And he became very nervous by this. Then he began to have mail interference, where his mail would arrive opened and resealed, but done in a way where somebody clearly wanted to make it obvious to him that the mail had been opened. Mm. You know, there's no attempt to hide it. In fact, it was the exact opposite, as if somebody wanted to send a message to him. And the message kind of got him in a similar state to Forrestal, where he became very paranoid, anxious, and felt people were watching him left, right, and center, and with hindsight, they probably were. Now, he was found dead in a Florida park in 1959, sitting in his car with the engine running and with a hose pipe going from the exhaust through the front window. It looked like a classic case of, you know, suicide from carbon monoxide poisoning. But weirdly parallel in the situation with Forrestal, as I said, Forrestal was killed or died or jumped out, if you want to look at it, the night before his brother was going to take him home, possibly the night before he may have planned to go publicly what he knew about UFOs. Well, the night before Jessup's death, he found a friend of his, Manson Valentine, who was also a researcher of UFOs and ancient mysteries, and said, he told Valentine, basically, that he'd uncovered something amazing and he wanted to meet with Valentine the very next day. And so Valentine was intrigued and said, yeah, you know, let's get together for lunch or dinner. Well, that didn't happen because, as I said, Forrester was found dead in this particular park. And it looked like a suicide, but there were some very odd aspects to it. For example, he was never autopsied, which, you know, is bizarre because just because it looked like a suicide didn't mean it was. The easiest way during an autopsy to check if a person did die from carbon monoxide poisoning is to check the blood content for carbon monoxide. You know, if they were breathing when they died, they would have obviously had it in their lungs. Mm-hmm. If he was dead before he was put in the car, then there wouldn't be any carbon monoxide in his lungs because he wouldn't have breathed any in because he was dead. But mm-hmm. nobody thought to check that. There are other things as well. For example, the window, aside from where the pipe went in, was stuffed with wet rags and towels. And Mrs. Jessup, his wife, confirmed they weren't the family's towels. Now, that might sound odd, but, you know, nobody can really say, of course, what goes through anybody's mind when they decide to kill themselves. But it would seem odd that he would deliberately go out just to buy new towels. You know, why not just take a few from the house with him? The other thing was that the towels were soaking wet. Somebody had wet them essentially to, you know, prevent any air getting through or anything at all. But the water was clear and fresh water. Now, there was a lake next to where he was found dead, but the water was lake water, and it wasn't the water on the towels. But there was no container in the car or anywhere near the car to suggest that he could have brought the water with him and then soaked them then. And oddly, nobody thought anything strange about that.
Let me address that, if I can, Nick. I got an email earlier, and the guy is now on the message board. And he grew up near Matheson Hammock Park and said that in the park itself there were there was showers and fountains that someone could have gotten fresh water from. I don't know.
Oh, yeah. No, don't get me wrong. The idea that fresh water was used, you know, isn't in dispute. I mean, somebody could have got it. I mean, that's actually a very good point that you know, the person makes. What I find very suspicious is the fact that no container of any sort was found by the car, in the car, in the trunk, anywhere. And so, in other words, whoever soaked the towels, even if it was Jessup, somebody removed, you know, the container afterwards, which suggests it wasn't Jessup. So for that reason, I'm not a cop, but I find it baffling that nobody gave any thought to, well, where did the water come from? And even right. if it came from the park, where's the container? And when you couple that with the fact, you know, new towels, and he was going to phone Manson, he was going to meet with Valentine to tell him this amazing discovery. And, you know, the towels, the water, the discovery, you put all those together, and then on top of that, no autopsy, then to me, that is a really weird situation that, for me at least, points to like a staged suicide.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Very well can be. Now, starting out in your book was the Maury Island incident, and to me, that's one of the fascinating ones. I mean, it was a very, very early case. And the donut-shaped crafts, one of them gets in trouble. It drops something down on the boat, kills a dog, injures a boy. And there was some recovery. And Kenneth Arnold is actually involved in this. A lot of people don't know that. Kenneth Arnold, who supposedly had the first sighting. Pardon me. But in that case in particular, one of the things I wanted to talk about, and we can do a little nutshell of it, but Lieutenant Brown and Captain Davidson, you know, crashed with the evidence in the plane. And the question I was going to ask you, yes, it is a mysterious death and, you know, very strange how that whole thing, there was a man in black and all that. But in your opinion, why would the government kill their own if this was if this is a conspiratorial situation?
Well, I mean, there are a number of theories. I mean, you made a good summary of the case there, you know, so I don't need to go over that. But, yeah, what basically happened was when this strange wreckage was found, it was handed over to a guy named Fred Chrisman, who turned up later in the Kennedy assassination, of all things. And he then, from Chrisman, the media got hold of the story, then the military got hold of it, and they flew these two guys from Army Intelligence out to Maury Island to pick up this strange wreckage and transfer it back to Wright Field, today called Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio. And they were First Lieutenant Frank Mercer Brown and Captain William Lee Davidson. Well, they picked up a bunch of this wreckage, and I actually reproduce a rare photograph of a piece of the wreckage in the book, which has surfaced through the Freedom of Information Act. The document, I should say, has surfaced, not the wreckage. But so basically what happened was that Davidson and Brown took to the skies to fly to Wright Field with this wreckage that they carefully stored in like a box and loaded aboard the plane. Well, they hadn't got long into the sky when the plane caught fire and crashed to the ground. They were killed, and the wreckage was reportedly never found by the emergency crews that were on the scene very quickly, even though a lot of sort of personal details and items of the crew that were killed was found. You know, you would think like a large chest containing this material might well stand out, but, you know, it apparently didn't. But there are a lot of weird stories about the crash itself or the explosion. There was one theory that the aircraft itself had actually been sabotaged. It was, you know, a bomb on board that sort of blew it up from the inside out. There was another very weird story that Kenneth Arnold himself talked about. He said, Arnold himself, that the guy who had the arguably the most famous and first UFO encounter of the modern era on June the 24th, 1947, Arnold said he'd heard that the B-29 aircraft that they were flying in was blasted out of the sky by a cannon fired by a detachment of the military, like another detachment. And Arnold actually came to believe that there were like warring factions within the military, some that were wanted, even at this early stage, that wanted the whole thing keeping under wraps, and others wanted to get it out to the general public. And Arnold actually talked about the possibility that, you know, there were these factions that had differing agendas in relation to, you know, what should be done with this material. And that was one of the theories, that somebody decided this isn't going to reach Wright Field. Otherwise, you know, if the story comes tumbling out, we're in big trouble. Let's just, you know, finish it right now. And, of course, there's talk of the idea that what if there had been a UFO in the area, and it was a UFO that essentially blasted the aircraft out of the sky to prevent the military getting its hands on and understanding and possibly even replicating the wreckage. So you have multiple different theories, but it all comes down to one thing, that the two guys, Brown and Davidson, both died when they were flying reported UFO wreckage to a military base for inspection. And that on alone, you know, is, I think, a matter for debate at the very least.
Right. Nick, you know, we only have like 3 minutes at this point. So, you know what? And I asked you earlier if you would be willing to do an extended version. So we'll continue on after the live show. But up on the message board is a question. And do you think that you want to comment any on the John Mack case when he was run over in England? A lot of people say that was just a plain accident. But
thoughts? I mean, I don't have Mack's death in the book, because I actually personally do think it was an accident. I mean, and I'll explain to you why. One of the things I point out in the book is, you know, over the years there have been literally thousands and thousands of people in the UFO field, researchers, authors, investigators, radio hosts, you know, TV personalities, you know, all across the board. And, you know, the most of them have not died under unusual circumstances. Mm-hmm. They just lived out their lives and you know, died of old age, or just a case of genuine car accidents or whatever. You know, we're all human. There's nothing special about people in ufology. We're all the same, and accidents happen, and sometimes somebody has a heart attack at, you know, 25 or something. In the same way, sometimes you'll see, like, a sports player, you know, drop dead on the football field at 25 or whatever. It does happen. Now, this comes back to Mack. And John Mack, when he died, he was in London, England, where I'm originally from, on a Saturday night. And he was crossing the road at a regular crossing place. And, you know, I've lived in the US for 13 years. When I first came over, my instinct was to look, when I'm crossing the road, to look in one, you know, to my right for oncoming traffic if I'm crossing the road, because in England we drive on the left, you know, and vice versa. But, you know, my instinct was that I would swing, you know, the wrong direction when I was looking. And I actually, a couple of times, you know, went across the road when I realized at the last second, I was like, wow, you know, I just missed a car because I was looking in the wrong direction for the oncoming traffic. Mm-hmm. And my suspicion is that when Mac crossed a London road busy on a Saturday night, and that his instinct was to look to his left for the traffic coming on the right-hand side of the road, forgetting that in England we drive on the left, so he should have looked to the right. And he just strode out and was hit by a car. And he was just hit by a member of the general public who was drunk. He was over the limit for driving. So, and there was, you know, it wasn't like a staged event in the middle of nowhere. It was a Saturday night on a busy London road. There were numerous people around at the time who tried to give help. It wasn't like, you know, in some dark back street and he was suddenly found hours later. You know, it's kind of like you imagine, if it happened on like Times Square on a Saturday night, that's what it was like. And the guy was, as I said, was found to be over the limit. So, you know, I mean, it's one of these that people might want to debate, but I think the evidence does point towards just a tragic accident. But because he was a key player in ufology, there's always this tendency to think it was mysterious when, you know, a lot of them aren't. You know, this is one of the awkward things with this subject. You have to be very careful which ones you assume were mysterious and which ones were just due to the fact that, you know, we're all human.
Right. And that's it for our live show, Nick. So just hang in there. So this is our extended version right here now with Nick Redfern. And Nick, up on the message board, we had a person asking a question about the Todd Sees case in Brazil, where the gentleman was zapped by a beam from a UFO, supposedly, and died a horrible death.
I mean, this is a sort of really weird story, probably one of the weirdest out there. And it's kind of notable because it actually predates the modern era of ufology by 1 year. 47 was the year of Roswell, Kenneth Arnold, Maury Island. But back in 1946, specifically March 1946, there was a very bizarre incident which occurred in a Brazilian village called Araca Igumwama. I think that's about how you say it. My Brazilian's not great, but that's close enough, I think. And it involved a farmer named Juan Prestes Filho, and he was 44 years old at the time. And it was Saturday night, and he was walking home after doing, he had a day fishing in the local river, the Tietê River. And he had a good day, you know, just hanging out, chilling out, walking home. This was late at night, and he had that kind of feeling that we all have at times, that somebody's watching you. You know, if you're in sort of the line at the checkout or whatever, you suddenly feel that somebody's watching you, turn around, and somebody is looking at you, you know, from 40 feet away. We all get that now and again. And Prestes, he had that feeling all the way home. He just could not shake it off, the idea that somebody was watching him from the shadows, so to speak. Well, even when he got home and got in his house, he still could not shake that feeling off. So he kind of was pacing around and looked out the window and saw this large, bright light hovering in the sky. And what was weird was the fact that it was silent and it was hovering. You know, nobody was flying anything that could fly silently at that time. Now, it could have been a helicopter. Helicopters were flying, but they've always got that sort of classic, you know, that rotor sound, and there was nothing at all. So he stared at it, only to be suddenly bathed in this bright, burning light, which just essentially just hit him. Now, with hindsight, looking back, it almost sounds like a microwave or something like that. Mm. I mean, if you when you microwave food, one of the reasons why the instructions tell you let it stand for a couple of minutes afterwards isn't just because it's boiling hot. It's because the microwaves actually continue to cook from the inside out for a while. That's why they tell you to let it stand, because it is literally still cooking. And that sort of sounds a little bit like what happened to Philho, is that his body began to get hotter and hotter, and he kind of felt like he was developing immediate sunstroke, but he didn't stop there. His skin began to blister and go red, and not surprisingly, he ran screaming into the streets, and by the time locals in the village and friends had caught up with him, his skin wasn't just starting to blister, but it was starting to peel off. And somebody loaded him into a car, and there was like this frantic race to the local hospital. By the time they got there, his skin wasn't just peeling, it was falling off him, and it wasn't just his outer skin either, like with a sunburn, you know, when your skin peels. It was like his flesh was starting to literally drip off of his bones. The hospital, reportedly, they rushed him in, and the doctors looked at him and had no clue what was going on. They could just literally stand there. That was all they could do, as his body essentially melted. Now, it sounds like a sci-fi type story, and you sometimes, in these situations, you think, well, there's just going to be no way to back this up. But fortunately, from the perspective of the research, there actually is. A number of the people who are involved came forward years later to 100% confirm the event. One of them was a medic named Arasi Gomide, who came forward in 1974 and confirmed the events, and people were able to confirm also that he did work at the hospital and was on duty that night and so on. And he talked about actually seeing the guy brought in and how he sort of had this bizarre melting experience. So the fact that we've got known and named people from the hospital is a bonus in terms of vindicating the story, and it's one that really is almost like unique, which is in a good way. You know, the idea of somebody having their skin melted off them, there's really nothing else like that in the UFO subject.
No, there's that one case in Canada where the guy had grill marks on him.
Yeah.
Here's another question on the message board. Someone wants to know if you address Phil Snyder's death.
I don't have that one in the book, mainly just for one reason, that the contract I had with the publisher limited me to 65,000 words. So the challenge was to, you know, include what I could, and in some cases had to be left out. I actually could have made the book like 100,000 words. But what I would say is that Phil Snyder's death is like Maurice Jessup. You know, it's one of these that was passed off as suicide, but did not look like suicide. And Snyder was one of these insiders who was talking about everything, like underground bases and the Dulce rumors of an underground base at Dulce, New Mexico. And there are a lot of anomalies with his death as well. And again, kind of like with Forrestal, I mean, an entire book could be written on Snyder's death. It's a very strange one that sort of leaves it open as to whether it was suicide or not. But, I mean, he was touching on and talking on about a lot of, you know, controversial issues, much of them to do with sort of government conspiracies, you know, political things, military things, nothing to do with UFOs. So maybe that angle possibly had, you know, at least an equal, if not a more of a bearing on it as well.
Right. To me, one of the most fascinating cases is the Thomas Mantle, the high-altitude crash. You know, he may have just passed out, but the whole story is when he hit the high altitude, but the whole story is that, you know, they were trying to say it was things like Venus and, you know, crazy things like that when, you know, a number of people cited this thing. Can you go into that case a little bit for the person who may not have heard it?
Yeah, well, Thomas Mantell was a guy, a pilot, very well respected, and had a sort of career from the Second World War, very well trained pilot, you know, lots of experience. And he died on January the 7th, 1948. He was on board an aircraft, along with three other aircraft. They were flying back from a training mission to Godman Army Airfield, which is actually a portion of Fort Knox in Kentucky. And the ground personnel at the base had been watching this strange object high in the sky and at a distance for something like an hour or so. They could not figure out what it was. There were thoughts it could have been a balloon, but it was totally stationary, which, you know, doesn't happen when you've got winds and so forth. It's not just going to hang there. So as the guys returned from their flight, bear in mind there were four of them, they were flying P-51 Mustangs, and the ground personnel said, you know, can you vector in and have a look and see what this object is, because we just haven't got a clue. Now, it turned out that none of the guys actually had oxygen equipment and oxygen masks. One of the planes was low on fuel, so what happened was that the plane that was low on fuel landed. Another pilot was slightly disoriented from lack of oxygen, and so he decided to land. And one of the other planes, as a precaution, sort of shadowed him down to the ground, which meant that where there originally been four planes, there was now suddenly just one. And so Mantell was the guy who said, well, yeah, you know, I'll go and see what it is. So he took his plane to a height of about 15,000 feet and said that he could now see the object fairly clearly. And he described it as sort of bright, gleaming, and very, very large and just hanging in the sky. Now, bear in mind, 15,000 feet with no oxygen is a, you know, a bit of a feat. I mean, if you walk up a mountain 15,000 feet and you've got no oxygen, people do, you know, people become exhausted quickly. They become dizzy and, you know, stuff and vertigo. And it's not surprising. Now, when he actually got his plane to its sort of ultimate height, which was around 25,000 feet, what happened was that the plane then suddenly plunged to the ground. Now, there have been theories that he may have been zapped by a UFO. We can never rule that out. I think it's probably more likely that he did pass out through oxygen deprivation. But that doesn't take away the fact that the whole reason why he was flying that high was because he was pursuing this object or trying to close in on it. So regardless of whether the UFO was responsible for his death, the fact is he wouldn't have been up at that height if there wasn't a UFO there in the first place. Now, there are two various and wildly varying theories put forward for his death. One was that he was mistakenly chasing the planet Venus and perceived like a faraway object at a closer level. That theory was thrown out the window when it was proved that even during daylight and at that altitude, Venus wasn't viewable. And, of course, why should, if it was there, you know, every other day or whatever, when the orbit, you know, allowed it to be seen, why was it never seen on any other occasion by the ground crew or pilots? Why was it just on this one occasion? So that theory didn't really hold much water. The second theory that was put forward for Mantell's death was that he'd mistakenly intercepted a Skyhook balloon. These were new balloons that the military was flying at the time. The problem with that theory is that Skyhook balloons, you know, they would respond to the drafts and the winds and so on. This thing was clearly stationary for more than an hour, so it suggests that it wasn't a Skyhook balloon. Now, Captain Edward Ruppelt, who was the first head of Project Blue Book, one of the early UFO study programs that the Air Force put together, even he came to believe that the balloon and the Venus theory didn't hold water, that Mantell potentially had viewed a genuine UFO. One of the weird things about this particular case is the nature of Mantell's body after it was recovered from the crash. You know, normally, if you have a sort of very bad aircraft crash, you know, when they talk about, you know, recovering the bodies from the aircraft, very often there actually isn't much of a body left. You know, very often they're just pummeled in the accident. But the weird thing is, and this actually comes, you see why this is important, this actually comes from a very credible source who under, you know, any other circumstances, no one would even consider questioning his word. This is a man named Captain James Duesler. He was actually the deputy commander at Godman Air Force Base, where Mantell was based. And he said that he actually saw Mantell's body after it was recovered, and there was not even a single scratch or a little bit of blood on the body at all.
Right.
Apparently, all of his bones were shattered, but there was not one exterior mark on the body in the slightest, which, you know, is kind of strange to fall from 25,000 feet and not even have a scratch.
Absolutely.
That in itself, you know, and coming from the deputy base commander, you know, that's sort of a significant portion of the story many people don't know about.
Another very compelling case that you talk about in your book is the Frederick Valentich case. The poor young kid, 20 years old, he's up in this small aircraft going on a solo and, you know, sees this craft. It scares him to death. And you know, the radio transmissions from that are the transcripts are just horrible. Can you talk about that case a little for someone who hasn't heard about it?
Yeah, well, this is a weird one because he ended up totally unexplained, not with a confirmed death, but with a complete total disappearance.
Right.
It happened on October the 21st, 1978, and Frederick Valentich, as you said, he was only 20 years of age at the time, but he's a very skilled pilot. He actually got his pilot license when he was like 18 or 19. And he was flying on that particular night from a place called Moorabbin Airport, which is in Melbourne, Australia. And he was flying a small Cessna 182 aircraft. And he was supposed to be flying to a place called King Island, Victoria, which was, I think, around about 120, 125 miles away, something like that, over an area called the Bass Strait. Well, the flight began as normal. You know, he took to the skies, he was in regular contact with the ground personnel and so on. And then he reported something strange that he actually asked the ground radar people if there was any other aircraft in the area, actually below him, several thousand feet. They said no, they weren't tracking anything else in the immediate area, and certainly nothing directly below him. So he kind of shrugged it off and just carried on flying, but he could still see this thing, which he described as a large aircraft, but he couldn't figure out what kind because the light array wasn't like the regular light that you would see on an aircraft at night. And so he couldn't confirm what it was. It was just brightly lit by four lights. You know, it wasn't like the sort of typical green, red, and white lights that you see on a plane. And whatever it was, it actually closed in on Valentich's aircraft, and he reported all this live, so to speak, as he was speaking to the radar people. And this conversation was actually recorded as well by the ground personnel. Mm-hmm. And it was almost as if it was playing like a game of cat and mouse, you know, closing in but not actually taking any sort of direct action, so to speak. Now, he actually said at one point that the thing was orbiting him, you know, as if it was just sort of circling overhead somehow at a very low level. And this is when he got sort of really scared. And he decided the best thing to do was to try and continue onto King Island and then just land the plane. And his last words were, "It's hovering and it's not an aircraft." And what was weird was that immediately after that, there was this sort of strange metallic/electronic noise that went on for a number of seconds. And that was the last it was ever heard of. Now, because there were concerns that he may have crashed, emergency personnel were sent out extremely quickly. We're talking about like Coast Guard people, military emergency teams, even people in the local boats were asked, you know, can you have a look round? Have you seen anything crash out of the sky? Do you see any explosions? There was nothing. There was no oil slicks, no gasoline slicks, no wreckage. Nobody saw anything fall from the sky. For all intents and purposes, Valentich and his plane were just gone, literally gone. He was never been seen again despite various attempts to find him and the different theories that what if he staged the event and, you know, started a new life somewhere else. Nothing like that has ever been even remotely, you know, proved to be the case. So this is a case where, as I said at the beginning of this particular section, that we can't say for sure it was murder or, you know, he died, but he definitely vanished and never surfaced again. And, I mean, he wouldn't be an old guy now. He would be, we're talking 25, 35 years ago, so he would be 55, 54.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, as I said, chances are that had he survived, I mean, you know, he would still be around to talk about the events. So it's a very, very weird and mysterious one. But the important thing is it's actually supported by a huge official file on the case, which runs to hundreds of pages, which has now surfaced through the Australian Freedom of Information Act and tells the entire story from beginning to end.
Yeah, it's almost, you could almost speculate that he and his plane were both abducted, actually. I mean,
yeah.
You could speculate that. For sure.
Especially well, that may exactly be what happened.
Especially when you hear the metal, the metal noises. So, Nick, this is a great book, Close Encounters of the Fatal Kind, and that you can find that on Amazon. We also have a link on our website. What do you have coming up? You write all the time. Are you writing something right now?
Yeah, well, I've got a lot of different interests. I've actually got a book, actually like a co-authored one with Brad Steiger, which comes out in September. It's called The Zombie Book, and it's like an A to Z of everything to do with zombies in movies, TV, novels, folklore, history. So it covers everything like The Walking Dead, Dawn of the Dead, but also things like ancient Egyptian traditions on how the dead could supposedly be brought back to life. And there are entries, there's like 500 entries in the book on different subjects. And there's entries on viruses, you know, is there anything close to the real zombie virus, you know, that kind of thing. So that book will be out in September. And my other big interest, which is cryptozoology, the study of unknown animals.
Yeah.
I have a new book coming out on that, all about my expeditions into the Chupacabra, various expeditions I've been on to Puerto Rico looking for the Chupacabra. And that'd be sort of like a road trip book of me sort of racing around Puerto Rico looking for the Chupacabra and stopping off and having a margarita here and there or whatever.
Both books sound great, actually. Thanks so much, Nick, for joining us. And
thanks, buddy.
To have you back again after you write another UFO book.
All right, cool. Thanks a lot.
Great. Well, that's it for the show today. You can check out links to the Chilean UFO photos, etc. Our guest next week will be Stan Gordon. I want to thank everyone for helping out with the show today. Our guests, of course, Leslie Kane, Jose Lai, and Nick Redfern. Keith Rowland, producer for the Dark Matter Radio Network. Andy Fleming will be back next week. Carrie Lloyd Whitehouse for our music. Peggy Shining for managing our Facebook page. And remember to like us on Facebook for all the latest UFO news. You can check us out live next week right here at the Dark Matter Radio Network. And every Wednesday at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And don't forget to jump in our chat room at podcastufo.com. This is Martin Willis reminding you to keep your eyes to the sky. See you next week.